This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the Nigerian government has confirmed that 110 female students from the remote town of Dapchi are missing after suspected Boko Haram militants attacked their school 1 week ago today, Monday.
That's Chika Odua reporting from Dakar. Full details coming up.
Also, the United Nations and South Sudan's government say more than half the country's population faces extreme hunger. And the president of Turkey starts a five-day visit to northern and west Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the Nigerian government has confirmed that 110 female students from the remote town of Dapchi are missing after suspected Boko Haram militants attacked their school 1 week ago today. For VOA, Chika Adua reports from Dakar that while Nigerian authorities have launched an intensive search operation, the action has done little to ease the anger at how this could happen again.
A remote town in northeastern Nigeria, a government girls' secondary school stormed by gunmen believed to be Boko Haram. Dozens of girls missing. Parents devastated. A town in mourning. These are flashes of the past week in Dapchi, an old farming community in Nigeria's Yobe state. It feels eerily similar to Chibok in 2014. Confusion reigned in the initial days following the Dapchi attack, as it did with Chibok. But there have been differences. In 2014, the federal government response was slow. Within 48 hours of the Dapchi attack, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari tweeted that he was sending a delegation to the town and ordering military and police deployments to find the missing girls. Information Minister Lai Mohammed visited the community Sunday.
The total register of the students that came to school on that Monday was 906. As of today, 110 of them cannot be accounted for. Henceforth, the police and the civil defense corps will ensure that their presence are strong in every school so that they will serve as deterrents to insurgents.
But activists are not placated. The Bring Back Our Girls movement is back on the streets in Lagos and Abuja, demanding answers from the government. Aisha Yasufu, one of the faces of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, says the similarities between Chibok in 2014 and Dapchi in 2018 are too striking.
We've had this before. Didn't we learn anything? We have refused to even assimilate what is going on now because it's heartbreaking. 4 years invested, seeing parents crying, seeing how much their lives have been shattered, and then we are coming again and another set of parents are going to go through the same thing.
The names of 105 missing girls from Dapchi were released over the weekend. The residents of Dapchi are angry. When the Yobe State governor came to visit, they threw rocks at his motorcade. Residents are gathering every day to protest. The Nigerian Air Force says it has deployed additional aerial assets to search for the girls day and night. A security analyst told VOA it is still early days, and some of the girls could surface after hiding in the bush. Bring Back Our Girls activist Iman Shehu says the government failed in letting this happen again, but there is some cause for hope.
The difference now is there is a response. Even though it's a late response, the government has been to the place several times, which didn't happen in Chibok. Now the federal government has put out a proper list, which didn't happen in 2014. Now there is talk of a rescue operation, which didn't happen in 2014. The Dapchi girls may be lucky this time around.
It was April 14, 2014, the day Boko Haram kidnapped 276 female students from Chibok. The mass abduction became emblematic of the Islamist radical group's insurgency. Some of the Chibok girls have escaped. Others have been freed via negotiation. but 112 Chibok girls are still missing. A regional military offensive that began in 2015 has reclaimed much of the territory Boko Haram once held. Speaking Monday to VOA's Daybreak Africa, Information Minister Mohammed said the Sambisa Forest, Boko Haram's largest stronghold, has been leveled. But the brazen attack in Dapchi is casting fresh doubt on President Buhari's repeated claims that Boko Haram has been defeated. Chika Odua for VOA News, Dakar.
The ongoing conflict in South Sudan is pushing millions more people in the country closer to famine, says a new report by the United Nations. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Nairobi.
This year, food insecurity in South Sudan could affect more than 7 million people, some 60% of the country's population, if they do not receive sustained assistance, says the United Nations. A joint report by three UN agencies says that currently, almost half of the population has been at a crisis level of food insecurity since January. Serge Tissot, the Food and Agriculture Organization representative for South Sudan, says the worsening situation is mostly due to the expanding conflict.
Even with the humanitarian support, we have still 1.9 million people who are very close from famine.
Parts of South Sudan were declared famine areas in early 2017. The UN warns that famine-like conditions could return during the lean season, May to July, unless assistance and access are maintained. To prepare, the UN World Food Program is pre-positioning food in areas likely to be cut off during the rainy season beginning in April. It plans to pre-position 20% more food supplies than last year, some 140,000 metric tons, in more than 50 locations. South Sudan's civil war broke out in December 2013 and has since forced 2 million people to flee the country. Another 2 million are internally displaced, and most are unable to grow their own food. Crystal Wells is the regional spokeswoman for the International Committee of the Red Cross, based in Nairobi. She says aid agencies are constantly responding to emergencies, providing food aid to the displaced and medical care to war wounded.
It's one of our largest responses in the world, and that's because the needs are just so great. So it's very important that the international community continues to provide support to humanitarian organizations such as the ICRC, because it's literally a difference between life and death.
The UN's Tissot says he's confident international aid will prevent famine from reemerging in South Sudan. But he notes food aid to the country, some $1.7 billion a year, is unsustainable.
The solution is not only through the distribution of food. The fourth solution should be through a peace agreement and the rehabilitation of the agriculture sector in South Sudan.
With the conflict now entering a fifth year, that kind of solution is nowhere in sight. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan authorities, together with aid agencies, have deployed teams of health personnel to address the growing cholera outbreak among refugees from the DRC. The outbreak has claimed nearly 30 lives. Hundreds of suspected cases are being monitored. Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
Uganda's health ministry and donor partners have set up treatment centers in two refugee settlements after they confirmed an outbreak of cholera among people fleeing violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. A multi-agency task force is coordinating the response in the Changwali and Chakatu refugee settlements. Yona Tukundane is Senior Public Information Assistant with the United Nations Refugee Agency.
Preventive measures are in place to contain the disease, and surveillance activities are ongoing, and these include house-to-house visitations, referral of the cases, reporting the cases, analysis of the data and the sources. And as I speak now, our medical teams are working hand-in-hand with the Ministry of Health.
At least 26 refugees have died in the outbreak, and there are more than 600 suspected cases. Cholera brings on severe waterly diarrhea and vomiting. It can kill a person within a few hours. It can be spread through eating and drinking foods contaminated with feces of an infected person. It spreads quickly in areas with poor sanitation and limited space for personal hygiene, such as crowded refugee settlements. In the Ugandan settlements affected, Aid officials say the water and sanitation facilities are too limited to serve more than 40,000 new refugees. Ahmed Mahat is the team leader of Doctors Without Borders at the Changwali Settlement Treatment Center.
Currently, the water liter per person is really inadequate. We have around only 6 liters per person at the reception center.
The anti-cholera task force has stepped up screening of refugees at entry points into Uganda to ensure no one infected reaches the camps. Medical personnel say some refugees contracted the disease in their hometowns or on the road as they fled their country's violence. Dr. Fred Kugonza is the disease surveillance officer in Uganda's Hoima district, where the affected settlements are located.
We are aware that there is cholera in Congo, so it is assumed that whoever is coming in has cholera, because even when they come the first day or second day, they get symptoms. So we need to treat everybody coming from Congo as a suspect.
Kugonza says the medical teams are overwhelmed by the numbers and need reinforcement.
Because now we are getting more cases, we need to deploy people in all these places, which is going to be a big challenge. We need more support from other partners. We need more people to deploy. We need more people to volunteer in ensuring that we are enforcing hygiene and sanitation improvement.
The government is sending additional medical supplies to the camps. Since the start of the year, nearly 43,000 new DRC refugees have arrived in Uganda. About 28,000 fled inter-ethnic violence in the DRC's Ituri region and entered Uganda across Lake Albert using fishing boats and canoes. Most of the rest arrived from North Kivu through Uganda's southwestern borders with the DRC, mainly in Kisoro, Kanungu and Toroko districts. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Today, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan starts a 5-day visit to North and West Africa. The tour is the latest effort by Turkey to project its influence across the continent and enhance its global presence. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, there are concerns that the Turkish leader, with his emphasis on Islamist themes, could be stoking regional rivalries and even tensions.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is scheduled to visit Algeria, Mauritania, Senegal and Mali in his tour of the region. Since 2005, as then Prime Minister, Erdogan has made developing deepening ties with Africa a priority, according to Emre Çalışkan, a Turkey Africa analyst at Oxford University.
Since he became Prime Minister, he has been in Africa 24 times. Since 2009, when he became President, he was in Africa 12 times. There are several ambitions, economy, being a global leader, and like use of Islam.
Earlier this month, Istanbul hosted African ministers for a week of meetings. Such gatherings are a regular occurrence and are part of Ankara's efforts to court African leaders. Turkey has tripled the number of embassies across the continent in less than a decade. Despite such investments, the economic returns have been disappointing, and that has led to Ankara to shift its priorities, says Africa expert Professor Mehmet Arda of the Istanbul think tank EDAM.
When we look at the Turkish trade with Africa, it's basically the same as it was about 10 years ago. So it is more a way of projecting itself as a power in the world. Moreover, Turkey puts itself as the friend, at least, of the countries which are the left behind, the destitute and all that. So I think from that point of view as well, it fits with that model of Turkey projecting itself on the world stage.
President Erdogan has, in recent visits to Africa, increasingly inserted Islamic themes in his speeches, which have sometimes been coloured with anti-Western rhetoric and focused on the West's colonial past, even though the Turkish Ottoman Empire once also extended to Africa. Analyst Çalışkan says courting African Muslims offers Ankara potential important diplomatic gains, as well as risks.
50% of the African countries come from Muslim backgrounds. And this gives leverage for Turkey in the eyes of Europe, in the eyes of West, and in the eyes of Africa. But there is a rivalry between different Islamic groups. These countries are Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. Historically, these countries are very influential in the region among the Islamic communities. Now, Turkey is a latecomer, but a newcomer and a strong comer. And Turkey wants to be more influential.
Last September, Turkey opened its largest overseas military base in Somalia. The opening of the base has been interpreted as a signal that Ankara is sending to the region of its growing aspirations. The Turkish Navy is rapidly expanding, with even plans for the construction of an aircraft carrier. Ankara's agreement with Khartoum to redevelop the Sudanese Suakin Island, that was once the Ottoman Empire's main naval base, has sent alarm bells ringing in Cairo, which is concerned about the increasing Turkish military encroachment. Ankara insists its development plans on the island are non-military. But analyst Çalışkan says such denials will do little to defuse tensions, given the level of mistrust between Erdogan and Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi.
Turkey has a difficult relationship with the Sisi regime, and they are both trying to influence on the areas that actually historically Egypt has been powerful. So actually it's a direct challenge to Egyptian hegemony in the region. If Turkey will be moving to a region more, of course there will be more rivalry with the Egyptian government as well.
Analysts warn the rivalry in the Middle East is already overspilling into Africa, a process that's likely to continue with Turkey's growing commitment to the continent in its bid to become a global player. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Nigerian government has confirmed that 110 female students from the remote town of Dapchi are missing after suspected Boko Haram militants attacked their school 1 week ago. The United Nations and South Sudan's government say more than half the country's population faces extreme hunger. And the president of Turkey starts a five-day visit to northern and western Africa today. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Protest organizers in the DRC say police killed at least two people Sunday when they fired on anti-government marches. Thousands of people took part in protests across the country. The Catholic Church organized the marches to demand that President Joseph Kabila hold promised elections and leave office. Church officials and witnesses say police fired on crowds in the capital, Kinshasa, and also in the cities Mbandaka and Kisangani. Police deny that anyone died in the demonstrations. Kabila's final term in office was to have ended in December 2016. However, his government has delayed arranging elections and he has stayed in office. Ethnic and militia fighting in various parts of the DRC have created a growing humanitarian crisis with tens of thousands of people displaced.
The UN Children's Fund reports at least 90,000 children have been forced to flee their homes in the face of escalating intercommunal violence in Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Ituri's Jugu territory in northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo has been the scene of recent carnage and displacement, with tens of thousands of people fleeing their homes in fear of their lives. The UN Children's Fund reports ethnic violence in this province has displaced an estimated 66,000 children internally and sent another 25,000 seeking refuge in neighboring Uganda. Violent disputes between the Hima and Lendu ethnic groups over cattle and grazing issues erupted in December, after lying relatively dormant over the past two decades. Conflict between the two groups intensified early this month with destructive force. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bourirac says more than 70 villages have been burned down. He says more than 76 people have been shot dead, a majority women and children.
Au moins 3 centres de santé et 7 écoles ont été pillées. et ou incendiés, privant les enfants.
Bouliarak says at least 3 health centers and 7 schools have been pillaged and or set on fire, depriving children of an education. He adds that education has been interrupted for some 30,000 children in more than 100 schools throughout the region. UNICEF warns that thousands of children risk falling ill from diarrhea, cholera, and other diseases because of exposure to bad weather, lack of food, and safe water. The agency says it and other aid agencies are distributing blankets, soap, safe water, and other essential relief to this needy population. UNICEF is calling for a peaceful resolution to this conflict, noting an end to violence is the only way to protect children from the many dangers facing them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports the Mauritanian government is issuing birth certificates to thousands of Malian refugee children who were born in Mbara camp, giving them important legal protections. We once again go to Lisa Schlein, who reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Refugee children who lack a birth certificate more often than not are considered as stateless. They have no identity. Legally, they do not exist and are stripped of basic rights. The UN Refugee Agency welcomes the decision by the Mauritanian authorities to issue birth certificates for some 7,600 Malian children born in Mbara, a sprawling refugee camp along the Malian border in southeastern Mauritania. UNHCR spokeswoman Cecile Puyi calls the Mauritanian government's certification of these births a groundbreaking development for refugee protection in the country.
They have also set up a system allowing for all newborns in the camp to be directly registered from now on. This is good news because it will help us fight against early and forced marriages, and it's also important if at one point people are able to repatriate on a voluntary basis, of course, and when security allows.
Since birth certificates provide proof of age, Puyi says this can be crucial in identifying cases of early and forced marriages. This, she notes, also will allow aid agencies to assist children at risk. Around 52,000 Malian refugees live in Mbara camp. It was established in 2012 when widespread insecurity in northern Mali prompted thousands of people to seek refuge in Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania. Aid agencies agree persistent violence in northern Mali is likely to discourage large-scale returns anytime soon. In the meantime, the UNHCR and partners continue to provide life-saving assistance in Mbara camp. But Puyi indicates this is fast becoming a mission impossible. She says her agency has had absolutely no response to its $20 million appeal for humanitarian operations in Mauritania this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Ethiopia is set to undergo a major political change following the unexpected resignation of Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn. The nation is now under a 6-month state of emergency, as declared by the defense minister, but the U.S. State Department says it strongly disagrees with a call to declare a state of emergency. A discussion on Ethiopia.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.